You are about to listen to an episode of The Cypher before it was The Cypher. For our first 75 episodes, we were known as Outside the Lines with Rap Genius, and we had a slightly different format. In all honesty, our production value and sound quality today is much improved from these early episodes. That said, the content is so great that these shows are a valuable part of our archive. If you want more information about our transition, make sure to check out episode 76 with Ritz, which was our first one under the new name. To keep up to date on everything involving The Cypher, visit us online at thecyphershow.com or find us on iTunes. And now, without further ado, here's The Cypher before The Cypher.
Rap Genius. I was DJing at clubs and I was out in the streets and I was like the only person that the artist knew that worked for a label.
Welcome to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. I'm your host, Same Old Sean. This episode, we bring you an interview with Paul Stewart. Complex magazine called Stewart an unsung hero of LA rap, and a listen to this interview will show you just how right they were. From the beginnings of his career with Delicious Vinyl, helping to make stars of artists like Tone Loc and Young MC, to managing people like Coolio, The Far Side, and Warren G, to his current career at Over the Edge Books, Paul Stewart has seen and done it all, and he shares it with us here. From overseeing massive international Grammy-winning hits to being sued by billion-dollar corporations, you'll hear all of Paul's ups and downs in this chat. As always on Outside the Lines, we bring you a special kind of audio footnote. Every time you hear this sound,
Rap Genius.
Go to rapgenius.com and search for OTL57. There, you'll find audio, video, and more information to bring you further outside the lines. And now, here's our talk with Paul Stewart. Same old Sean, I'm here with Paul Stewart. How you doing?
Good, thanks for having me.
Of course, of course. So for our listeners who might not know, can you give us a little bit about who you are and your background? We'll go through it in depth in the
Sure, no problem. Well, I'm born and raised in Los Angeles in the Baldwin Hills neighborhood, which is part of the Crenshaw District, kind of the bourgeois part, but it's right above the infamous jungles portrayed in Training Day and stuff. So I definitely grew up in a very urban environment, which is pretty rare in Los Angeles for a pretty segregated city, actually, surprisingly enough, you know. I got into DJing in college, and which was about 82 is when I started DJing, 83, 82. And so hip hop was brand new. You know, it was just in on the West Coast anyway. For us, it was brand new. You know, we were just starting to get records and everything. And so, you know, I started DJing. And then when I moved back to Los Angeles, I was in school in Northern California. I started a little magazine where we interviewed NWA and Queen Latifah on her first trip to LA. And shortly after that, I got into street promotion. And I worked at Delicious Vinyl. Actually, my first job ever was at Delicious Vinyl, and I took Young MC and to New York for New Music Seminar, and I promoted Tone Loc's debut album and everything, and that was a marvelous opportunity. It was just like eight people working at the company and stuff. It was so small. And after that, I took a small job that didn't last, and I didn't have a job, and I started doing street promotion and didn't really know what it was. It was so new. There were really like two people who did it out here, and but kind of put a new slant on it. We went to the hood. We went to all the swap meets and everything. But we also covered Hollywood as there was starting to emerge, you know, this scene of hip hop outside of the community or the ghetto areas and stuff.
And that was the company that you called PMP eventually?
Correct, right. Yeah. It started off as PMP, Power Move Promotions. And, you know, I worked some amazing stuff. Steve Rifkin had the account with Elektra, so we worked all the Brand Nubian, Leaders of the New School, Pete Rock. I started working for Tommy Boy, and I got put on retainer, and so we worked De La Soul, Naughty by Nature, Queen Latifah.
And when you would work a record in those mm-hmm. days, what would that mean?
We would go to the swap meets and the record stores that existed in the hood and in which there were a lot of, you know, all over Los Angeles, you know, area, you know, LA's so big, you know, We would go to the record stores. We would take promo copies, typically for the store, possibly posters if we had them, stickers. When artists would come to town, we would take them around. You know, we would take, I remember we had a plan to take Naughty by Nature to a lot of stores. It didn't quite work out.
But, there's a story behind that.
There is. But we went.
Can you share it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Shakim, who is Tretch's manager and has managed Latifah her whole career, you know, is an amazingly successful, smart guy. You know, we went to the swap meets and all this stuff because that's where you really broke and sold records at that time in Los Angeles. And so we had put together an itinerary for Tommy Boy, and we had done this with artists like Paris and other artists on Tommy Boy's label. And he was like, Tretch can't go to these stores and everything. And like, you know, and we were like, we didn't understand what he was saying because we're like, we go to these stores. Why can't he? But he had a really valid point, you know, because Tretch, the way his hair was and everything like that, he looked like a gangbanger. I could go to these places and no one looked at me twice. But, you know, a black guy in a white beater with hair braided up in Slauson, I was like, yo, cuz, where are you from? And, you know, instantly drawing a lot of attention and stuff. And so so that didn't happen.
Rap Genius.
Supposedly there was an incident. He went on his own to a swap meet or something. And something happened. But in Mid-City, but I won't get into that. But
sure. Yeah,
but so we took artists to the stores for in-store signings, for events, you know, where they would do like, you know, people would come, they have an in-store, you know, we would promote to radio, mix shows and the college radio. We weren't dealing with, you know, like big commercial radio, which wasn't playing hip hop at that time really at all anyway, hardly. So it wasn't much of a factor.
Right. I mean, it sounds like you were basically doing the job of what now these days is split up into two or three different firms.
Yeah. Yeah. No. And we would, you know, like with Naughty by Nature, for again, you know, we'd had the OPP campaign. We're putting the stickers everywhere, you know.
I remember.
Yeah. Yeah. With Cypress Hill, we were really involved in getting some like important press on them and some kind of like cool street magazines. I wrote for The Source at that time. I had a column about West Coast hip hop. They had regional reports. And so I was like the first journalist to ever write about Cypress Hill. And, you know, and so, you know, we would just, anything that we could do to put in our little report and show that we were getting something done. You know, I mean, we would take people to parties, clubs, you know, we would, you know, get involved in booking them possibly live, you know, events, record release parties, you know, like, yeah, you know, anything that we could do to get a buzz.
Cool. Well, I wanted to take it back for 1 second.
Okay,
to
sure.
You were talking about Delicious Vinyl.
Yeah.
And, you know, what I remember of that era is just like all of a sudden this stuff popped up on MTV and was had huge crossover success, the Young MC and Tone Loc stuff. And I was just curious how that looked from the inside.
Well, it was an amazing kind of like ride. And I came in after Wild Thing hit. So then they had some money and I was hired to help work Tone Loc's album. And at that time, at Delicious Vinyl, all I did was retail. So I would call record stores all across the country and be like, do you have the record in stock? Can I send you a promo copy? And at that time, there was no sound scan and the stores reported to Billboard. And there was much, you know, shady business going on. Like, you know, people would send boxes of clean. I mean, all these records that were on the Billboard charts, half of them didn't sell at all. But people were the record promoters, you know, at the major labels had sometimes, I don't know if they would outright pay people, but they would give people boxes of what they would call cleans of these records. So if they couldn't sell them in their store, they could return them to the distributor for cash or other products. So it was basically like giving them money, you
right.
know? And,
I didn't know about that particular scam.
Yeah. Yeah. And, there was a, you know, and they would, you know, take these guys out to lunch or whatever, kind of like, you know, on the corporate credit card and things that we didn't do it Delicious, but our records were really hot. And, you know, I would send people, for the most part, I would just send them promo copies. There were a few people I sent boxes of records to, you know, to try to get them to, you know, really important accounts, you know, to try to get it up on the Billboard charts. But for the most part, it was happening pretty organically. And
Rap Genius.
You know, it's funny. I mean, I remember I booked Young MC for a show prior to when I was at Delicious Vinyl at this tiny club called The Cover Girl in Culver City. And the guy who booked the show was like in high school in Culver City, and it was a bar. You know what I mean? It was like, you know, there were all these high school kids in there, and it was, you know, we did a show with Tone Loc and everything there, and that's when they were first buzzing. I mean, there was a street development of these artists before it took off huge, especially like, you know, with Tone, his first single wasn't Wild Thing, you know what I mean? And so, you know, it was Chiba Chiba, you know what I mean? And so, you know, there was, you know, that didn't blow up huge or anything like that. And, you know, and Young kind of came out the box, you know, swinging really hard. But I was there from the beginning of that, you know, and it, you know, it was definitely, it didn't, you know, it wasn't like a huge, like, you know, year build up on the streets grinding, but there was a development process before it just kind of took off. I think after Tone Loc's video blew up, MTV was really excited to see what Delicious would bring next. And when they brought Busta Movin', it was such an obvious kind of like, you know, follow up for them in there that they got behind it right away. And so, and yeah, they were just looking for hip hop videos at that time because there were very few.
Yeah.
Like if you made a good, halfway decent song in a video, you could get it played, you know, on their little slot
right. where
they played rap videos and nowhere else on the network for sure.
I was curious about those guys' personalities because, you know, the impression, at least via the media, yeah. was that, you know, Tone Loc was kind of like the personality and the star, and Young MC was the guy who was, you know, doing the writing. And
let me give Tone Loc some street cred. He was a thug. I mean, he was like Hoover's Crip or whatever he was. You went to Tone Loc's house. He had this big house on Olympic, I remember, near Fairfax. And I mean, it would be like 20 of his homeboys smoking. And, you know, I mean, it was like he was really not to be messed with. But he was, he was really affable. He was the big jolly guy, you know. And he was smart enough to kind of like play the role. He wasn't like trying to, you know, like Sugar Fee trying to beat up like program directors or radio stations or anything. You know, he was smart to play the role and he kind of went along for the ride and everything. And, you know, Tone's this kind of guy who was like right place, right time, had that amazing voice, you know. And yeah, I think he kind of realized that he was like, you know, hey, this is a good look for me. And, you know, I don't want to rock the boat too much, you know. But, and Young Marvin, you know, Young MC, a great guy, still friends with him. I mean, you know, he was a, you know, USC student, you know, came from a middle-class neighborhood and, you know, wasn't an ounce of street, really. It wasn't very street, let's put it that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And he was, you know, trying to very decidedly make music that was, you know, cleaner and more directed towards a pop audience, that which was kind of like taboo at that time. Besides guys like Will Smith and everything, you know, there weren't people really gunning for that. It was, you know, viewed as like selling out, which was still kind of a big deal. And you didn't, and you know, the labels were still like barely figuring, you know, the major, they were barely in the rap business and trying to figure it out. And they did some horrible, you know, pop attempts. But for the most part, trying to be pop wasn't something that a lot of people were really gunning for. So he was kind of unique in that way, you know, and just a really smart guy and super talented lyricist and, you know, and, you know, kind of the brains in a way where he wrote a lot of the stuff, you know. He co-wrote with Tone Loc, Wild Thing, you know.
Rap Genius.
Yeah, yeah. So of the, in the street team days, what are some kind of, you were going obviously to lots of different places and
yeah.
tiny record stores and
yeah.
distributors and all that. Any, and a lot of times with artists, any kind of really crazy encounters?
Oh, man. It was so long ago, man. I'll probably remember some halfway through the interview, you know, I think. But
well, who was artist-wise, who was easiest to work with and who was maybe a little more challenging or eccentric?
Oh, man. I mean, you know, a little bit later when I started managing groups,
right.
I'll try to get back to that. You know, like the Far Side, who was, you know, was a lot of fun, was kind of a nightmare because there were four personalities. And I remember in the car on the road to like the airport to go to England, and Fat would be like, I can't go. I got to stay and work on that remix, you know? And he was kind of one of the guys that, you know, and he's a good friend of mine, but he wanted to, you know, scare the success almost, you know, was, you know, and was kind of fighting it in some regards to that, you know. Coolio, who, you know, interestingly enough, you know, when I started working with him, had been, in the game for a long time. He wasn't young and everything. It was, you know, real street. I mean, like, I remember the first time I picked him up, he lived in Nickerson Gardens Projects in Watts, which is probably one of the most, you know, dangerous places to live in Los Angeles. And, you know, he was a breeze to work with. You know, he was so excited for the opportunity and he did everything and never missed anything. You know what I mean? But I got to think about the street team thing. But there were definitely a lot of artists that flaked and were hard to deal with, and you catch some egos and stuff. But at that time, for the most part, artists were still, you know, it was, hip hop success was such a new thing still that most people were really like, they weren't taking it for granted the way I see artists right now, that it could even really happen. So they were kind of like doing what they were told, and they were kind of like, you know, you know, cats would be flaky, and I'll talk to some of my old street team members, and they'll remind me of some incidents, I'm sure, you know what I mean? But, you know, and there was a thing there, too, a little bit, where it was like, you take a guy and do, you know, he's, even though most guys weren't claiming really gang sets at that time, but it would be like, well, you know, we're going down in this neighborhood, and, you know, and so they would certainly be particular about maybe what they would wear, or, you know, there was certainly the, like, different gang neighborhood thing that was a little bit of a challenge to deal with.
Definitely. And you alluded to in that last answer, you moved from there into management.
Right, yeah, right.
And worked with Coolio and Farside, a couple others.
Yeah, House of Pain, Warren G. Yeah, and it was a really natural progression. I mean, what happened was I was at the clubs. I was a DJ at that time, too, which really helped me a lot because I was, while I was just kind of coming up in the hip-hop business, before I worked at Delicious, I had an internship at Arista. And I was like the lowest person on the whole thing. But I was DJing at some pretty cool clubs in L.A. And I remember one time this woman, Violet Brown, was really influential in L.A. She bought all the music for black music for the Warehouse chain. And she called up the office because she wanted me to put her on the list for this legendary hip-hop club called Water the Bush that Ice-T was involved in, that I was a part of. And my bosses lost their mind. Like, why is Violet Brown calling you? And almost got in trouble, you know, like I called into the big boss's office and they're like, what's going on here? You know what I mean? And they didn't utilize any of that, you know, but, so, you know, it was, I was DJing at clubs and I was out in the streets and I was like the only person that the artist knew that worked for a label. I mean, like certainly no execs or A&R were out hanging in the clubs. I mean, LA didn't have hip hop labels like Def Jam or Tommy Boy, didn't have offices in LA. The major labels had no understanding of the culture. You know, we're signing stuff pretty much exclusively out of their New York offices. You know, the McCullas and the Priorities and stuff were kind of more of a homegrown situation. And they, if they were dealing with clubs, might have been like some crazy Compton nightclub or something, you know. And I was more, like I said, out in the Hollywood scene and stuff like that. And so, you know, artists would start coming to me and because I was accessible and they would say, you know. And the first group that I managed that I only managed such a short time, I got on their record deal and was instantly fired, was House of Pain. And that's really how that came about. They knew me from the set. And, you know, Everlast just came up to me and said, hey, you know, I want my own manager. You know, he was kind of under Cypress's, you know, wing right then. And so we went out and shopped their demo and a lot of labels slept on it. You know, a lot of labels were like, you know, and Jump Around was on that demo, which is just inconceivable to me that, you know, And when I did the Farside, a lot of labels slept and Passing Me By was on the demo, you know, so it's pretty, but it was a much different time. And you shot demos at that time. You didn't have to have a buzz in the street or, you know, if the demo was good and they believed in it and they thought there was maybe some markability to the artist, they would sign it.
Yeah. And how'd you hook up with Farside?
Oh, that's a funny story. I was at this convention in San Francisco called the Gavin Convention. And
it was a radio thing, right?
Right. It was like college radio. And it was a big deal for us because the college radio was like, you know, how a lot of the stuff was being played around the country. And, you know, we didn't have access to the major radio stations weren't playing it. And so I was at the Gavin Convention and we were in this room partying. It was like 1 or 2 in the morning. We're smoking and we're drinking. Everyone's really faded. And Razkaz, who was a dancer at that time, and the Farside were dancers, knew the Farside, and he brought him up to the room as he worked with this guy, Lano Brazil, whose room it was they were hanging out in, and they said, and he brought him in, and then Raz was like, yeah, these guys rap or whatever, and Lano, and there was a guy from Tommy Boy in the room, but, you know, who's like a marketing guy, and for some reason he said, Lano said, well, I had just got House of Pain their deal, he said, yeah, you should rap. This dude gets guys record deals, you know? And they got in this little huddle and they came out and they started doing a song about your mama so fat, she ate 22 burritos, and they're jumping up on top of the bed and everything. And we're just dying. I mean, we're already high as a kite and we're in there just laughing and you know, and so I got their number, whatever. And I remember the next day I was like, were they really good or were we just like so faded?
Rap jeans.
That we did, you know, and so then it's funny, I came back to LA and I met Jay Swift because Jay Swift wasn't with them. And we had this meeting and everything and we went to this seafood restaurant and the bill came and I was, you know, trying to be Big Willie and pay for the bill and my credit card got denied. And they had to pitch in.
Some baller manager,
yeah,
you are.
Right, and they had to pitch in and help pay for it and it endeared them to me. And when it happened, they said, you're our guy. Actually, they loved it, which is funny. And their current manager, who was a really great guy, Reggie, Reggie, who teaches in Watts and like brought up Tyrese in his class. He teaches a music class in Watts. You know, he was an old school R&B guy, you know, got down with the Whispers on his group. And he didn't understand. They had been more of an R&B rap group before. And he didn't understand the new direction the Far Side was taking with Your Mama. He was scared to play Your Mama for A&Rs. He thought they're going to get, in, you know, offended by it and everything. It was, you know, too radical for him. And so, but he was putting him up in this little apartment building in Inglewood. And so when they told him they wanted to go with me, he kicked him out. I would have, you know. Right. And so they came to live with me, and I had a one-bedroom back house in Hollywood on, like, Sunset and Highland. And so they all slept with me. Like, we were all sleeping on, basically on the floor on little air mats or whatever. And at night, I remember at night it would be like, you know, all the Your Mama jokes and the clowning. And it was a fun time, you know. And, you know, it's funny, like Def Jam, A&R, Tracy Waples came up there, and Russell famously slept on the Far Side. He said, oh, yeah, this is some West Village, you know, weirdo kind of shit or something. You know, it's too eclectic. You know, everything had to be hard then. And so, you know, and Delicious just, I had worked there, and so I knew them. And it was just like that kind of home environment where, like, four crazy individuals who couldn't agree on anything could, you know, kind of find home. And Mike Ross and Matt Dyke, you know, were talented producers. You know, they had done the Young, and you know, they weren't involved in the production on the Far Side's album or anything, but you know, they understood the nature of hip hop and artistry and that kind of thing, and let us kind of, like, you know, take a long time to record the album. And you know, there was no album budget. It was just like, here's your advance. It costs what it cost, which I always thought was the smartest. I never heard. I don't know any label that did that, but it made so much more sense to me than, like, you know, how can you put a number on what it's, you know?
Right. Yeah. What was it like recording their breakthrough record?
Oh man, the Far Side was just a lot of fun. You know, I mean, we were crazy young guys, and we were all in it together. And you know, it was this whole kind of, you know, it was this great spirit. I mean, like, this kind of, like, you know, there was that whole, like, really exciting wave of the hip hop, like Tribe and everything that was going on. And we just really felt like we were a part of this kind of new movement. And, like, you know, but we didn't know if anybody was going to care. And, like, I mean, I remember when the first single didn't really happen, you know, Put Out Your Mama, and it didn't really happen. And then when we did Pass Me By, you know, it took off. I remember we went to New York. I think it was Funkmaster Flex was, like, at the Palladium, which was, like, the hottest club at the time. He was, like, cut at the height of the night at midnight. Like, he was cutting up two copies of Pass Me By. It was, like, the hot song. And the guys were, we just lost our mind. I mean, it was like a hip hop wet dream. We're just like, you know, we fantasize, you know, about just, you know, all these artists. And me, we're all fans. We're all big hip hop fans. So to go and have our record be like the one, you know what I mean, was just like unbelievable, you know. And it's kind of sad because I don't know if it was that trip or the next trip, but I think it was for the college, the CMJ, went out there, and the guys had a show, and it was XXL Records, Craig Collins label, you know, and there was some group, Big Boots, I forget. But anyway, a riot broke out at the concert, and a couple of the guys from the Far Side got you know somewhat injured in it, and seemed like some of the New York guys were kind of like, I didn't think so at the time, but according to the Far Side, was basically, you know, kind of coming after the Far Side. It was a full melee. I mean, the club, you know, chairs getting thrown and tables and, you know, and just everyone. And I remember I was in a back room with Far Side, with Fat Lip, going like, shit, or, you know, what's going on? And they were never the same after that, like, you know. And I remember, too, you know, Tupac, they ran into Tupac on the road, and he was like, you guys aren't gold yet? I hear your single everywhere. You must be gold, you know. And that kind of messed up their head. They started thinking that Delicious Vinyl was cheating them, and you know, they kind of got, you know, some of the white man's the devil, you know, and they got a little, like, they just, their whole innocence was gone, you know what I mean? And I think, you know, I liked the second album, but, and I wasn't involved in it, you know, I was for part of it. Suave, who started managing them, he was a road manager at the time, and he became their co-manager. And he was active helping save them at that melee, you know, and you know, not to be cowardly, but I was in the back room, you know, that's where I ended up. I was just, you know, I wasn't like trying to not help anybody or anything. I had no idea what was going on, you know, but you know, that earned him a lot of points, and Suave's a good guy. We're friends, you know, and he ended up managing the group after that. And, you know, in the second album, but the innocence that they had and that kind of like fun spirit that made them so special kind of got, you know, I think a little, they lost a lot of it after that trip, you know. And so
it's funny you say that, because you definitely notice a similar thing in New York artists from that era. I feel like if you listen to like a lot of Digging in the Crate stuff, like, you know, Show and A's first album is like funny and playful, and then the next album is just fucking like they were facing murder charges, and it's just like dark.
And I think a lot of people had these naive, and myself included, had naive understanding about the industry. And, you know, we're so happy to get signed and get a deal and we get our little check and it's a lot of money to us. And then all of a sudden, you know, we start to realize the big picture, you know, and the major labels and the indie rap labels, too, were really screwing artists for the most part. You know, there were really no artist-friendly deals. I mean, people taking publishing, you know, for tiny advances, and no one understand what it means when they do the deals. And, you know, just recouping every paperclip spent at the label against your project. And, you know, the label makes millions of dollars on the project, and then and then they tell you you didn't recoup, you know, and you got some little tiny advance, you know. And so it was very, it was a, and still is a very unfair system for artists, you know. And most of us were just, you know, we're so happy to get, to be able to make a living or get in the door doing art or
whatever. Be on the radio.
When I first, the concept came into my brain that I could make money working in the hip hop industry, it was so alien to me. I mean, it was, I had no examples of that. I mean, this is the thing that your mom's like, turn that shit down. You know what I mean? Like that I could make a career out of this was just never fathomable to me. So we all came into it pretty naive, almost everybody, you know? And so, you know, so I think a lot of people got bitter, too, as they started to kind of realize the deal and as shady things happened to them. And, you know, a lot of people got taken advantage of by shady managers and, you know, and the whole, you know, the whole thing.
Is there anyone on the artist side you saw in those days, either who you worked with or saw around, who was maybe more savvy than the rest of the folks? Anyone you felt like, oh, they've got a good head on their shoulders. They know what's going on.
You know, there were a lot of artists that were smart. You know what I mean? Coolio was really smart. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, but none of us were like smart enough, like Master P, like business wise, like I'm going to own my stuff. It, not that we had the resources that he had either to put out our own music or, you know, I will say like Chaz Hayes and E40 and those Bay Area guys for sure. Like, and in part because they didn't have the industry up there, they were forced to do it themselves. And so many of those guys, and I, you know, I think credit them for doing it, but I think a lot of it was that they just didn't have those opportunities. But then, you know, like we have like a gold or platinum record and it's like they sell 10,000 copies and make more money than us or something. It was like, you know, later we learned the rules and the lessons, you know, but definitely let me give to Chaz Hayes, you know, a manager of, you know, an E40 and their whole crew was, you know, Short has always been a really smart businessman. He played the major label game, but obviously, you know, has been kind of a genius with his career and everything like that, you know.
And you worked with Coolio, who had been around for a while back then. What, God, what is it? The first thing.
The WC and the
WC.
He was a part of
WC
that.
WC and the Mad Circle.
He actually
album.
Had a record before that was on K-Day. And so he'd been around for a while, you know. And
that WC and the Mad Circle album is great.
Yeah. WC was, I managed him for a while. You know, it was a small, you know, it was a small community. I remember, you know, we used to record at this place, Echo Sounds, a lot. And Tupac recorded a lot of his material there. And I remember watching him, man, and just being like, whoa, you know, just the way his work ethic was just so phenomenal. You know what I mean? And so, yeah, no, Coolio had learned a few things from being through the industry. And he was grateful for the opportunity. You know what I mean? Like I said, and he, but, you know, we were all naive. I remember, you know, a great lesson I learned was his first album went platinum, and then, you know, we're talking to the label with our attorney about, you know, how much they owe us, and they go, well, actually you owe us money. And we're like, how is that possible? And we looked at the deal, and basically we had done like 5 videos or 6 videos. They paid for half the first video, and then the rest of that video and every video subsequent, 100% of it went to recoup against our little 12%. You know what I mean? So we had to pay off that in full before we would even get, you know, to see. So the recoup.
This was in the days of pretty extensive video budgets.
Right? You know, Coolio's first, it was a little before, it was kind of when it first started. Fantastic Voyage was the most expensive rap video ever made. It was $100,000, which, yeah, it's probably a lot by today's standards, or I don't know, you know, expensive for any kind of indie artist for sure. But, yeah, so the video budgets were just starting. It wasn't like Busta Rhymes, Hype Williams quite time yet. It wasn't like... we got to like, you know, the $500,000 videos and everything. So, no, but, you know, when we did Fantastic Voyage, I remember I was shocked they were going to spend that much money because Coolio hadn't broken. He had his first single was like a local hit. That they're going to put that much money into it, but they really believed in Fantastic Voyage, and they wanted to do an impressive video, and they were really notoriously cheap, Tommy Boys. So the fact that they were willing to spend that much shocked me. You know what I mean? And you know, in retrospect, it was good for his career. We probably shouldn't have done the next three videos, or you know, or whatever, or just I don't know. You know what I mean? Like, just we didn't even understand. You know what I mean? Like, I wasn't reading contracts. You know what I mean? I was like, you know, I was a hip hop guy. I knew a hit when I heard it. I hung out with the artists. I understood the marketing culturally, why somebody was important. You know, it took me a lot of knock on the heads like that too. But you know, I remember our attorney at the time was a real smart guy. Goes, okay, well, we'll tell them, you know, we want $1 million advance before we go in and record the next album. Now we have leverage. They need something for us. And I was kind of like, this light bulb went on my head, and I was kind of like, oh, leverage. You know, that's what it's about. You know what I mean? And I don't think we got $1 million advance, but you know, the understanding was kind of there, and also that I needed to pay closer attention to these agreements. You know what I mean? For sure. You know.
And what was it like being working with him when he just broke so huge? I mean, you'd been around artists going pop since the beginning of your career.
But. Yeah. Well, you know, when Fantastic Voyage broke, I was on a real roll. I had, you know, I had Far Side, I had already, Warren G was right around the same time when Warren G, you know, I think maybe Warren G had already come out, you know, so I was having success, and it was kind of like, I just thought I had the golden touch, and everything that I was going to do was going to be, you know what I mean, it was kind of my experience to that point, you know, I mean, I had paid a lot of dues as a street promoter, and, you know, I had managed a few artists where it didn't quite happen, but you know, with Coolio, at least he stayed with me, which was great through the process. So that was a new thing for me, not losing the client after a lot of the success, you know. And yeah, you know, but it was also, you know, it was after the initial first hit of Fantastic Voyage, I went through a really tough time in my business. I had a label deal with Def Jam, and that went south, and they sued me. And so until Gangster's Paradise came out, I was struggling again, you know. So my career has always been a big up and down roller coaster ride, you know, to this day, you know what I mean? So
Gangster's Paradise was the kind of the hit that,
oh man, yeah. I mean, that was such a big record. It was the biggest selling single of the year in the United States. We toured in all over the world. We remember we went to these countries, and there wasn't a rap record in the top 10. There wasn't even records in English in the top 10. And we'd go in there, we'd be in the top 10, and we'd do these shows. People didn't speak a word of English. They're singing every word of the song. It was mind-blowing, you know what I mean? And so, you know, it was great. And it saved me because I was in this peril, you know, a perilous position where I had built up this big company, and I had a lot of clients. I was managing, like, Lighter Shade of Brown, you know, all these clients and all this stuff. And but you know, I wasn't generating the income that I needed to sustain the employees that I had working for me, though none of them got paid a lot of money, but even just the overhead of the office and, you know, that kind of thing. So yeah.
What was the, to the extent you want to talk about it, what was the Def Jam thing about?
Well, you know, what happened was, I was young and kind of naive, and I think maybe I got some bad advice from some of the people around me and stuff, but, you know, what happened was, in my deal with Def Jam, I was able to manage artists, you know, and I had several management clients like Coolio who weren't signed to Def Jam. And similar to their, you know, Rush management, they had kind of had those arrangements.
At the very beginning of Def Jam.
They had that kind of deal with themselves. So they saw the power in me having important clients and why that was important, which most record labels would never have understood.
Right.
So,
I mean, people to this day still think, I still had in my head, even though it's not true, that Run DMC recorded for Def Jam, even
sure.
though they were just managed by
Russell,
Rush
right.
Management.
Sure, Rush,
yeah.
right. Yeah. So, you know, so there was a group on Def Jam called South Central Cartel. They had a couple groups on the West Coast label that had been very unsuccessful before I got there. And, you know, I sent them Warren G and Domino and you know, and so the, you know, I opened up the Def Jam West offices, and, you know, I was kind of like the beginning of the success of Def Jam's West Coast. And you got to understand, too, this was early in Def Jam's career. I mean, you know, it was after the Beastie Boys and Public Enemy and Slick Rick and all this stuff. But, you know, they were going through a lot of growing pains. And Def Jam had a reputation for not paying people. You know, at that time, they were definitely known for, whether it was true or not, you know what I mean, for not paying people. And, you know, when there was a singer who was part of South Central Cartel, this guy LV, who wasn't actually signed to the group, but was featured in all their videos and everything like that. So LV, you know, came to me like so many West Coast artists at the time and said, hey, you know, I want you to manage me. And I said, great. Because he had this kind of like, you know, gritty soul, like Curtis Mayfield kind of style. It was really up my alley, you know what I mean? And so, and the whole idea of singing hip hop, kind of like, you know, gangster singing or more hip hop, you know, the whole Puffy thing was starting to explode. And so the idea of more street R&B stuff was really taking off, or soul, you know? And so I said, yeah, you know, I got this label with Def Jam. And he said, I don't fuck with Def Jam. And I said, okay. And he had, you know, South Central Cartel hadn't had a good experience with Def Jam. LV hadn't had a good experience with South Central Cartel. And, you know, so his view wasn't very strong on the label. I said, okay, well, I can do that. And so as part of my deal with Def Jam, I was, you know, obligated to give them a listen to the demo of any artist first before I shopped them around. And so there was some dispute whether I did that. Ended up getting a deal for LV at Def, at Tommy Boy. And he was the guy who sang on the Gangsta's Paradise record. So, you know, so there started to be a lot of interest in him. Basically, Def Jam wasn't interested in him. I started to shop him around. At the time, we had the box, the video jukebox channel, where you could call in and request to pay 25 cents or a dollar and get a video play. And he had a video that was part of a couple of the guys from South Central Cartel's solo project. And it started blowing up on the box. And all of a sudden, Def Jam was interested. And, you know, Def Jam was going through a weird period at that time. Their deal with Sony was ending. They were about to go into their deal with PolyGram. Sony was squeezing them by not paying them any money. PolyGram wouldn't give them any money until the deal was signed. And, you know, to Def Jam's defense, they were in a squeeze, and some bills weren't getting paid, you know, studios, engineers, this kind of thing. And I was starting to think that, you know, it wasn't really a great place to be, you know. And then they came to LV directly and told him he should sign with them instead of going through me, which I thought was a big disrespect. And so, you know, I ended up doing the deal with Tommy Boy, and the next day Def Jam sued me. They fired me, they stopped paying me, and they sent a letter out to everyone in the industry, all the major labels, and they said, if you do a deal with Paul, you hire him, we'll sue you. So effectively tried to blackball me in the industry, you know, and was very upset with me. And in retrospect, I can see their point. I think they thought I was unloyal. Leora Russell, if you ever hear this, I wish you would understand my side. You know, I still talk, whenever I see them, I talk to them, it's friendly, but we've never gotten back. You know, we've tried to do a little business, we've never gotten back on the terms. And I think it's sad because I brought them a lot of success and really helped them. And I learned so much. I was like Leora's protege. I mean, this white guy who was into hip hop. I mean, Leora loved me, you know what I mean? And we had this, you know, great, you know, mentor kind of like, you know, relationship. And I learned a lot. I mean, he's just a beast, obviously, you know what I mean, on a business side. And I learned a lot from him. And Russell was still active in the label at that time. I learned a lot from Russell, met all kind of great people from Russell. And it was an amazing experience, you know, but I brought them Montel Jordan, you know, which was their number one pop hit and everything. And, you know, I made my contributions, you know what I mean? And so, you know, and so when the Gangsta's Paradise, so no one would really touch me. I wasn't making really much money in management. I had this big staff. I moved everybody into my house up in the Hollywood Hills at that time. And when Gangsta's Paradise broke, you know, I was having so much success, then the labels, everyone started to look at me again and go, well, let's see if Def Jam really has a case maybe. And Steve Rifkin, Loud Records, you know, gave me the opportunity. And, you know, the BMG lawyers who were his deal was through looked at the agreements. Ah, Def Jam doesn't have a case. You know, whatever, sue us, you know. So they did the deal with me. And, of course, Def Jam didn't sue.
Of course.
No, and so, you know, I got my second reincarnation of PMP as a label through Loud.
Wow.
Yeah.
And who were you working with at that time?
You know, I did a couple records that were, you know, the most successful was Delinquent Habits, who was, you know, an offshoot of Cypress Hill. And then I had a kind of a neo-soul artist named Adriana Evans, who was really kind of early on that trend. And I had a couple bricks, you know. I think I was getting a little gassed at that time, getting a little away from my roots, you know what I mean? I was trying to do what I thought would be dope as opposed to, like, more what I understood instinctually, you know what I mean? So, and also, though, to my extent, if I had had any kind of, like, if I'd been able to, like, this deal ended very shortly because, to my fault, too, and I remember Rick Rubin warned me about this. It was like, I tried, you know, I had a big staff, I had a big office, and he was like, keep your overhead low. And I was kind of like, yeah, Rick, whatever, you know, what do you know, you know? And
what do you know, Rick Rubin?
Yeah, right. And, you know, to my default, my cost was so high on the deal that when I didn't have a lot of really huge success, it didn't make sense, you know. And it was right when the industry was starting to change and, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah. So who, I mean, you've seen West Coast rap literally from the beginning. I know that, you know, 82, 83, like, even in New York City, people weren't always referring to the music as hip-hop by that point. It was still maybe, like, uptown music or whatever. Right. Like, so you've seen West Coast hip-hop from the very beginning. Who do you think of the West Coast artists from maybe the first decade or so is underappreciated, is not really who people don't really know but should?
Oh, wow. I thought you were going to say who's carried the torch, and I was going to say Snoop, because I'm a big fan of Snoop, and he's a really good guy. He was really excited to see what I did for Warren, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, there's groups like the Souls of Mischief and the Freestyle Fellowship on the underground side, you know what I mean? Some of the, you know, Bay Area guys, I like E40, I think is just amazing, you know what I mean? I don't know, man. I gotta think about that a little bit.
Yeah.
That's a tough question. A good one, though. I mean, there's, you know, some of the guys, like, that had great records, like Volume 10, you know, he never followed it up. You know
what
I mean?
That's what I mean. Like, this kind of, like, early pioneer, or maybe, like, who even only had one song.
Well, okay, King T.
Yeah.
King, can I swear?
Yeah, of course.
King motherfucking T is, like, I mean, you know, not only did so much stuff come out, like, the Alcoholics and... And somebody was tracing down his tree to me the other day, and it was like all these things that came, you know, but, you know, I mean, I think he was like making records that were so ahead of his time when he was making his early hip hop records, and was really like lyrically dope and just had some really funky records. So if you're not up on King T, go check out like Bass and, you know, I used to be a B-boy. I used to wear gold until I was told you're not a real B-boy. Ah. I used to wear silver. Till I was told, you're not a real B-boy if you don't wear gold, you know. But he was like all time, you know. He's not from L.A., but, you know, Def Jeff had some really good records. That was, he was like a West Coast artist, part of Delicious, you know what I mean. And so Mellow Man Ace, you know, was kind of got caught up in the like commercial thing. But and now he's gotten back to his underground roots. But, you know, the whole Cypress Hill thing. From Dubious, yeah. The whole Cypress Hill thing, you know, I lived next door to Muggs in Hollywood. It was DJ Muggs and DJ Aladdin. We lived in a really ghetto complex on like Sunset in Normandy. And they used to say it was only like heavy meddlers, strippers, and like rappers that lived in there. There were like shopping carts in the thing in the back. It was like ghetto, you know. Hollywood was really ghetto then, especially the east part, you know. And I seen Muggs form Cypress Hill. You know, and the style was a lot adapted from Funk Dubious, Sun Doobie. And if I remember something to the extent of like, you're too dope to be in the group, you need to go solo. Something like that was said, and, you know, it didn't quite work out for him, you know. And much props to Be Real and Sin and Muggs and everything. But I think, you know, kind of the lyrical style, a lot of that was got from him. So I'd say Sun Doobie, King T would be two of my top. Yeah.
And so you went from the, you know, music business, kind of transitioned into the film world a little bit, doing some music supervising for movies. You know, a ton of our listeners would know Barbershop and Hustle and Flow and a bunch of stuff. How'd you get into that whole thing?
Well, I was, like I said, I was a DJ, and I had this, I was DJing for a couple TV shows for the studio audience. I had gotten this gig where I DJed for the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air TV show. For their audience.
What was that like?
Oh, incredible. Yeah. You know, it was, I had never had such a civilized DJ gig. You know, they paid you in a check that actually came every week or whatever. You know, they fed you dinner. You know what I mean? You're sitting hanging out with Tisha Campbell, Will. Will's such a nice guy. You know what I mean? And the whole cast. I met people like Don Cheadle, who guest starred on that show, you know, so early in his career and everything, you know, and so... Just, you know, Benny Medina was the executive, and there was a guy named Matt Robinson who really helped me get in the game, and Matt and Benny were close, and when the show happened, Benny asked Matt, did he want to DJ for it, and Matt had his label, which I worked for at the time, and he was like, you know, I'm too big for that, but my man P will do it, you know, and so they called me DJ P, was my DJ name, and so I went, and I did it, and did it for like 4 or 5 years, you know. Eventually my sound guy took over, John Singleton made me quit. But anyway, so I was...
Was it intimidating to DJ in front of whenever Jeff was there, to DJ in front of one of the best DJs?
It was a little bit because I was not the best DJ. You know what I mean? But Jeff is the nicest guy in the world. You know what I mean? And so he never made me feel that way. Though I was a little like, you know what I mean? Yeah. And Will was great. I remember he used to introduce me to the show. This is DJ Paul. And I didn't go by that, but I would never tell him. You know what I mean? So like, but he was such a good guy. I DJed his first wedding and everything. You know, it was great to be a part of that family. And it really helped me transition into the Hollywood movie thing. I met a lot of the people from doing that, you know. And so from that show, I ended up getting like three shows. I did the Martin show when it first started. And then I did this show called Out All Night. And John Singleton came to the set one day of Out All Night, came up to me, met me, and... At that time, I worked for Ice Cube. I did street promotions and marketing. I did promotions and marketing for Street Knowledge Records. This is when they were in the hood. They were actually in the 60s, the infamous 60s hood. And this was like when he was putting out albums on Yo-Yo and Cam and the Lynch Mob and everything.
Cam, oh man. Yeah,
there's an underrated LA MC. Yeah. Cam, definitely. So anyway, I worked for Ice Cube, and there were like six people at the office, you know, and it was, you know, and anyway, and so when I met John, you know, I told him that I managed the Far Side, and he was just like, I think I was trying to get him to come to this. We were hosting a showcase of this group, the Wascals, that I was managing at the time. That was like the baby Far Side, and they kind of imploded, but was really talented. You know, these young kids came up under the Far Side, and So I was trying to get John to come to the showcase, and I yeah, you know, man, it's the Far Side. It's a big far. He's like, oh, I love the Far Side, you know. And then I told him I worked for Ice Cube, and obviously John had, you know, immense respect for Ice Cube, and you know, the fact that this white guy works for Ice Cube is kind of like an instant, like, you know, cred for me, you know what I mean? And so he was like, you know, I'm starting a label, and you should come over and run it for me and help me do my soundtracks. And it was just like, you know, the most amazing opportunity. I went, you know, and he got Cube's blessing, and all of a sudden I was the VP of New Deal Records, and I music supervised my first film, which was Poetic Justice, you know. And John's a great guy. I've worked with him a lot recently. It was funny. We were managing people as well, and we were managing Warren, which I had met by hanging out in the Death Row Studios with Snoop and Dre when trying to get the song delivered for the Poetic Justice soundtrack, which was initially supposed to be a Snoop song, and then Interscope and Death Row vetoed that, so we got a Dog Pound song, you know. And Warren was like, yo, cuz, I got my own stuff, and played me the song Indo Smoke. And I was like, whoa, this is, I remember I just ejected the tape after the first chorus. I was like, yes, we're putting this on the soundtrack. And I played it for John, he freaked out, and then we started managing Warren. And that's how my relationship with Def Jam started. I sent a video of the Mr. Grimm song to Chris Lighty, who was my friend. I had met him at the New Music Seminar when I was taking Young MC around, and he was the Jungle Brothers road manager.
Wow, so you went way back with Chris.
Yeah, yeah. And baby Chris, right? Yeah. And so Chris hit me back, and he was like, hey, who's the guy in the third verse rapping? And I was like, oh, that's Snoop Dogg's DJ, Dr. Dre's brother. And, you know, having missed out on the whole Death Row, West Coast Explosion, you know, the next thing I know, I got a call from Russell Simmons. And this is a funny story. He called me at the John Singleton's office, and I put him through. He said, hey, Paul, this is Russell, you know, with the list that he has and everything. And I thought it was one of my friends fucking with me. And I go, look, dude, you know, I don't play basketball all day anymore. I'm an executive now. I don't got time for this shit. You know, who is this? No, Paul, this is Russell, really, you know. I was like, quit fucking with me. And I was really rude, you know what I mean? And he was like, no, this is Russell. I was like, oh, shit, this is Russell. I had met him before, but he certainly never called me or anything, you know what I mean? And he was like, you know, we want to sign Warren. And then the next thing I know, I'm at Lior. And they flew me out to New York, and they wanted me to open the offices. And I was kind of doing it on the under, you know. There were some problems with the... working with John. He's a filmmaker. He wasn't really that focused on the music. But John found I went to Def Jam for a meeting, and he had me, the next day, I remember I went on like a Friday, called in sick or something. I came into the office on Monday, and he had me escorted off the lot, you know. I was like, yeah, he was pissed, you know. And we didn't work together for like 10 years. And he called me and goes, hey, you know, I'm doing Fast and Furious 2. Do you want to work with me? And then after that, I did Four Brothers and Hustle and Flow. And John's a great guy. I owe so much of my career to John. You know, I'm so grateful to him. You know what I mean? So, but that's how I got in the business. I did Hustle and, I mean, I did Poetic Justice. And then I met these other young filmmakers, and they had a film, and we don't have any budget for you. We got $5,000. And for all the music on the whole film. And I said, I looked at the movie. And I was like, oh, this guy's talented. He might be like next Spike Lee. I said, okay, I'll do it, but you got to look out. And it was this guy, George Tillman, and his partner, Bob Tidal. And ironically, their next movie was Soul Food, which Babyface produced. So they didn't have any juice to get me involved. And then their next movie was Men of Honor, which they hired me for, which is a $40 million period piece with Robert De Niro, which I was hardly qualified for, but you know, they hired me.
I got to hang out
with De Niro, and it was great, you know. And then, after that, they hired me for Barbershop 1 and 2, and that kind of took off my career, you know. And yeah. Then I started doing more movies, and then I hooked back up with John, you know, which really, you know, helped me doing Hustle and Flow, which was a huge coup for me. Yeah,
on the movie side, you know, maybe the movie you did that, if not the best known movie, the movie best known for its music is definitely Hustle and Flow.
Yeah, it was an amazing opportunity. I mean, everyone involved, like, I remember John gave me the script to read before he was able to raise the money yet. He was having problems getting the money. In fact, he ended up putting his own money, which is really amazing to make the film. And it paid off for him in spades too. But, you know, so he gave me the script, and we were working on Fast and Furious 2, and I remember I had a meeting somewhere in Beverly Hills or something, and I started reading the script like that morning or something, and I was so engaged. I actually took it in the car and was like reading it at stoplights, and you know, and it, like, almost got in an accident, you know. I'm like turning the page there. I wanted to read it so fast and get back to him so fast. And I just started working. Like, I wasn't hired. I just broke the script down, is what you do as a supervisor, like where all the cues are and everything, and just sent it to him. It was just like, I said, okay, so what do I do now? He's like, well, I want to hear beats from every producer in the South. So I started hitting up all the producers in the South, and, you know, you know, I remember, you know, it's crazy, you know, about a year later, they finally got the money and they hired me, you know. But, and John took us to, Atlanta for the All-Star game. And, we met with, you know, Rico Wade and Bone Crusher, Jermaine Dupri. Little John set it up. He said, it was to everybody.
He was the key to,
I had known Little John. We did A&R for Jermaine, you know, before he was even an artist, you know. So luckily enough, and he introduced us to everybody. I remember he introduced me to two people that weren't really known yet, so John wouldn't meet with them. That was T.I. and David Banner. And I remember I met with T.I. in the lobby of the Four Seasons where John was staying. I went downstairs, and when we had a drink or whatever, and he went to pay for the bill, and T.I. took out this paper bag full of money, you know, with rubber bands on it. And it blew my mind, because in L.A., I mean, yeah, most of the rappers really aren't that street that I came up around at that time, for sure. And a lot of cats were broke, fronting, you know what I mean? And, like, this dude had a paper bag full of money. I didn't even heard of him. I was blown away. And it's really ironic because, you know, Jason Jeter was there, and T.I., and they ended up doing the soundtrack for Hustle and Flow, you know, years later, you know what I mean? And so, and David Banner, I met with him in my hotel room, and I remember I was really embarrassed because that was like, I was getting ready to get on a plane. I was trying to smoke up all my weed before I got on the plane. And David Banner came in the hotel room, and I had a little hotel room next door for Four Seasons. And I was like, you know, do you want to smoke? He wasn't smoking at that time, where he doesn't smoke. I don't know. I didn't want to hit. And I felt like, God, the rapper ain't smoking and I'm over here smoking. I felt bad. Yeah. And then he played me this song, and it was the song with Little Flip, you know, Like a Pimp or whatever. And man, to John's credit, I remember I played this song for John, and he flipped out. And it was just a small regional hit at that time. And John put it in the beginning of the Fast and Furious 2. And it was like, by the time the movie came out, the song was a pretty big hit, but it hadn't been at all at that time. You know, John just had a great ear, you know what I mean? And so, and then David Banner was supposed to write the music for Hustle and Flow and kind of fronted, you know what I mean? So, but obviously he's got really cool with the director through the process. He's in Craig Brewer's next movie and all that stuff and everything. And David Banner is a great guy, man, like really serious guy. And I just really, I got a lot of love for him, you know? But sometimes people don't understand the opportunity that's in front of them. You know what I mean? It was small money and that kind of thing. And, you know, it could have been other circumstances. I don't know if he didn't do it for the money. I don't want to badmouth him in that way or anything.
You know? Right. And I guess my question in watching that movie all the time, and maybe, I don't know if you were on set, maybe you don't even know this, but like, who coached Terrence Howard in rapping?
Well, I was on set for some of it. it was my job when we first started the movie to meet with Terrence Howard and like play him a lot of Memphis records, like, you know, here's some Project Pat records, listen to them, in part for like the accent and the slang and everything. Don't come in here with some Atlanta slang, you know, somebody with Memphis slang and everything. So I was definitely involved in that process, but gotta give 3-6 a lot of the credit. I mean, you know, his funny story is that I remember at that time Terrence was playing a flamenco guitar. He's a really talented artist. He was like an R&B soul artist before then. He's like musically really talented, you know. And I remember I met with him. I went to the Standard Hotel in Hollywood, his room, and I was like, you know, playing him all this, you know, Memphis rap. And he's like, yeah, yeah, whatever. Check out my flamenco guitar shit. So he's playing flamenco guitar for me. And I knew Terrence. We had the same barber. And luckily, I had a relationship with him and everything. So I was like, yeah, okay, very cool. And we had a good rapport. And I remember he went out to Memphis, and John and Craig Brewer, like, you know, you gotta hang with 3-6 for a while. You know what I mean? You gotta soak it in, you know? And he went out there. I remember, I think it was Juicy J told me later. It was like, yeah, man, you know, this motherfucker was hanging out with us. And, you know, he was playing his flamenco guitar. And I think at first, you know, he was like, here's an actor. And, you know, actors don't come to Memphis. And so they're trying to be cool. It's a Hollywood thing and everything. Even though 3-6 Mafia is filthy rich at this time by their whole local, like, kind of thing. But they didn't have that national exposure or whatever. So I think they listened to him a little while. After about half a day, they were like, look, homie, you know, put your funky guitar up. You're here to learn from us. Nobody wants to hear your flamenco guitar. Where it kind of jacked him. But, you know, there's also an artist named Al Capone from Memphis that was involved in the process. He wrote the other songs that Terrence performed besides the one that 3-6 Mafia did. And he definitely was involved in kind of helping Terrence. And, you know, and Craig Brewer, the director, had a really good, lived in Memphis for a while, was a huge Memphis rap fan, and, you know, just knew what he wanted. And I think, you know, could smell it if it wasn't, you know, right or whatever like that.
Yeah. And you guys in that movie featured maybe my single favorite rapper actors, Ludacris, who I think is a phenomenal actor.
Yeah, it was great. I got to work with Ludacris and them on Fast and Furious 2. They did the soundtrack and everything like that. And, you know, I think he's like the next rapper actor to really break it big in Hollywood. You know what I mean? And yeah, I got immense respect for him and his man Shaka Zulu is his manager and everything for years. And, you know, they're really smart guys. You know what I mean? So there are some smart guys.
Yeah.
You talk about smart businessmen. They're smart guys.
Definitely. Yeah. And to get to the present day, your latest venture is a book company.
Yeah. You know, I wanted to produce films after music supervising like 40 of them. And, I realized I can do this, you know, after sitting around the process and can do a better job, I think, when it involves, you know, culturally the, you know, kind of our world, you know what I mean? And produced a couple films, and it was a real labor of love. And so I decided I didn't want to do it that way. And, you know, I had this idea for this kind of like Mad Max, you know, a futuristic film with hot chicks. And I was like, God, you know, I bet if I had a comic book, you know, I could get, you know, John Singleton and Reggie Hunt are comic book fans. And, you know, and so I hired these illustrators to draw the comic book. In the process of that, I started reading about the digital revolution that was going on in publishing. And this kind of light bulb went above my head. And I was like, you know, culturally, our stories aren't getting told, which was kind of my impetus for doing the thing that way. And I was like, you know, and I mean that culture in a broad way, not even just hip hop, you know, and urban culture and, you know, just edgy youth culture. And so, you know, I said, you know, I want to start a book company and start putting out projects as books and then, you know, build an audience or a foundation for them. Then hopefully Hollywood will come to us and we can make the projects more on our terms and kind of have a, you know, a quasi comic book like business model where, you know, we're involved in like film and TV rights on a lot of the projects and stuff. And so trying to actively pursue film and TV opportunities for the projects, you know, and, you know, it was been really just started reaching around to people I knew, like Mike Miller, who was an amazing photographer who had documented so many of the West Coast hip hop artists in the golden era and took so many great pictures. And so we did the coffee table book with him. And
if any of our listeners haven't seen that, we have a copy at the Rap Genius office, actually one copy on each of our offices on each coast because it's that good. It's an incredible, incredible book.
Thank you. The History of West Coast Hip Hop, Michael Miller Photography. And yeah, we got some real exciting stuff coming out. We got a biography of Pimp C we did with the estate of Pimp C. We have a Curtis Snow autobiography from the infamous Snow on the Bluff film. And, you know, I was really motivated when I was getting the company started, and I started talking to a friend of mine who's Curtis Mayfield's son, and was trying to help him get kind of a Ray type of movie going in Hollywood on his father, and I just started the book, and I said, hey, you know, we should do a book, and he's like, yeah, for sure, because there is no biography on Curtis Mayfield, and like, my jaw hit the floor, and I was just kind of like...
There's no full-length biography?
No. And I mean, it's just like, I just think, you know, the powers that be that control the publishing world and stuff just do not understand culturally the importance of so many things. And so I'm trying to, you know, there's great companies like Vice and things like that who don't publish a lot of books or even their magazine that much anymore, but, you know, do really edgy content and stuff. But, you know, they have a certain space in the kind of world that, you know, I live in and stuff like that is often neglected and stuff. So, you know, anybody listening that's got, you know, content, you know, where we read everything, we're open to, you know, we're doing some more photography books. And, you know, if you got something you think would be great for us, hit us up, you know, overtheedgebooks.com. Easy to find.
Excellent. Well, that's really great. Thank you so much for coming by. I really appreciate your time, man.
No problem. Thanks for having me. It was great to be here. I love Rap Genius. I'm a huge fan. I use it regularly.
That was our talk with Paul Stewart. If you like what you hear on Outside the Lines, make sure to visit us on iTunes. From there, you can subscribe so you'll never miss an episode. Also, make sure to leave us a review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the better chance we have of continuing to get great guests like Paul Stewart. You can also visit our brand new website at OutsideTheLinesPodcast.com and follow us on Twitter at OTL_podcast. Outside the Lines with Rap Genius is created and written by Sean Sotaro, a.k.a. Same Old Sean.
You know, he was playing his flamenco guitar, and I think at first, you know, he was like, here's an actor, and you know, actors don't come to Memphis, and so they're trying to be cool, it's a Hollywood thing and everything.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
I almost got in, like, trouble, you know, like, I called into the big boss's office, and they're like, what's going on here, you know what I mean?
Our intern is Julia Hannifin.
Also that I need to pay closer attention to these agreements, you know what I mean, for sure, you know.
Our music is by Psionic.
And then after that, they hired me for Barbershop 1 and 2, and that kind of took off my career, you know.
And the OutsideTheLinesPodcast.com website was created by Paul Dice.
You know, in retrospect, it was good for his career. We probably shouldn't have done the next 3 videos. Or
join us in 2 weeks when we talk to writer Lance Scott Walker about his amazing new book on Houston rap. We'll see you then, Outside the Lines.
Cool. So I can see that just fine.
Okay.
So cool. So I can see that just fine.
Okay.
So cool. So I can see that just fine.
Okay.
So